Welcome to the Adventurers Club of Los Angeles. I'm your program chair, Rich Mayfield, member 1211. Tonight, we're here with Rob Quisp, member 1207. Thank you for tuning in. We're broadcasting during this pandemic with a skeleton crew here at the Adventurers Club. We're going to continue to broadcast every Thursday, bringing you good stories of adventure at 7:45. So make sure you subscribe to our channel and click the bell so you're notified when we post new content. Always remember, you can watch these later as well. Via our YouTube channel. So the first thing we have tonight, Rob, I didn't really tell you about this, but before you go, we do have a check-in from the field, the far, far field. I think this continent is the only continent unaffected by the coronavirus thus far. So here's member 1194, Wayne White from the South Pole with a little bit of check-in for us. Roll that.
Greetings from the South Pole. I'm Wayne White, and the winter manager at the Amundsen Scott South Pole Station here on my third winter. What am I doing here? Well, I'm the captain of a ship that moves at 33 feet per year across the ice. With that, quoting from a famous captain, the path to my fixed purpose is laid with iron rails, whereon my soul is grooved to run. Over unsounded gorges, through the rifle heights of mountains, under torrents' beds, unerringly, I rush. Knots an obstacle, knots an angle to the Iron Way. South Pole Winter Crew 2020, the Iron Way. I hope this video finds you all well.
Thank you, Wayne. Cheers to you at the South Pole from the Adventurers Club. Actually drinking some Shackleton tonight, which is a pretty good brand of scotch. So other members, if you're out in the field and watching these videos from afar, feel free to send in a check-in. We'll air it on there, and we'd love to hear about your adventures. So send those videos in, and we'll get them up on this channel. So, Rob, welcome. Thank you for coming by.
Thank you.
So, Rob Quisp, you're member 1207, so you're kind of new to the club, but no stranger and definitely not new to adventure, right? Tonight, we're here to talk about your first adventure in 1964, right?
Right.
Very cool. So, let's get started. Like, this is, from what I understand, you were in the Army. You did a stint in the Army. And how many years did you spend in the Army?
3.5, but only 6 months of active.
Okay. So very short stint in the Army.
Right.
And this is, what age did you join the Army?
17.
17 years old. Is that as young as you're allowed to?
Yep. You have to have your parents sign. And I was kind of a cut up in high school, so it was a good thing for me to do at 17.
Gotcha. So you joined the Army, you got out of the Army, and then your first big adventure. So tell me where this adventure starts.
I'd been planning this for some years. I have always wanted to travel. It may go back to my heritage. All four sides of my family came across the plains. They were Mormons.
Oh, yeah?
And I don't know if it's genetic or what, but I just wanted to see the world, and I tried to go right after I got out of basic training, right after I got out of active duty, and the colonel wouldn't let me go. He wanted me to finish my education, which was good advice.
So you were in the active reserves, and basically
right.
You asked to go overseas, and he's like,
and
no,
wouldn't
no
let
way.
Me go until no that way. Was finished. So that was finished in 1964.
Okay.
And my dad was going hunting, as he does every year, in Alberta, Canada, bird hunting. And he invited me along, and so I said, well, that'd be a good way to start. That gets me a little bit across the United States, because my plan was to, for whatever there was of a plan, there wasn't a lot of itinerary.
Yeah.
But from there, I wanted to go see my brother, who was in dental school in Chicago. So after hunting with my dad for about 10 days, I just got on the road and Highway 1 and stuck my thumb out. And 3 days later, I was in Chicago. Met my brother and some of his friends. It was a very cold winter. The lakes had been frozen. I was trying to take a boat out of Lake Michigan.
And so you were gonna. Your plan was to take a boat from Chicago out through the Great Lakes, headed towards Europe.
Right, and I could work on the boat, and that would make it even cheaper.
And they had that. That was an option. You could actually work on a
boat.
It
was not that year because the lake froze early.
Okay, that makes sense.
So I hitchhiked to New York. Icelandic Airlines had this great fare, $99 round trip from New York to Luxembourg. It's on a DC-3. It took 18 hours in the air. You had to stop in Reykjavik, Iceland, to refuel because the plane couldn't make it that far.
Wow.
And it wasn't pressurized, as I recall, so you're flying real low. So it was a...
Not and cold? A, was it cold?
A,
or
little,
was it...
a little cold, not too bad.
But, okay. But this was a passenger airplane.
Yeah, it was a passenger airplane, but it's an old C-47. That's what a DC-3 is.
Right.
The old workhorse of the...
So was there, at this point, was there, because you already had a pivot, right? You wanted to go through the Great Lakes and work your way across on a,
right.
on a ship, but you couldn't do that. Was there any master plan for where you were going or where you were headed?
I was going to Europe, and that was about it. I had no itinerary. I had no reservations.
How much time did you have, and how much money did you have?
I had $1,000, and I had until I started UCLA my senior year in September.
So how long was that?
So that would have been almost a full year. I left on October 5th, and I returned on June 30th.
So you had $1,000 and 1 year. Whatever runs out first,
I have to come back.
You got to come home. Did you have like a reserve fund? Like I need it. Well, you bought a round trip ticket.
Bought a round trip ticket. I did have a little bit of money coming in, and I've forgotten exactly how much. Because when the first time the colonel wouldn't let me go on my trip, I took that money and bought a duplex and built out an apartment for myself in the back of that duplex, and that worked great while I was a student. Wasn't exactly the classiest thing in the world, but it was good for a student.
It was an asset.
Yeah, you could stir the beans while being in the toilet. They were just that far away.
But it was bought and paid for, right? And so
it wasn't bought and paid for. I was paying a mortgage, but I had renters in front, and they paid the mortgage and mine.
Oh, nice.
And so I lived free. And then when I went to Europe, I rented that out to a couple of students. So that was a few $100 a month, I guess.
Who managed that while you were off?
My dad.
Okay.
My dad and I had a real good relationship. And they weren't too sure about... You know, their 21-year-old son taking off.
But you're 21. They can't stop you, right?
No.
So you're on a plane, 18 hours, stopping in Reykjavik, Iceland, and you land in Luxembourg.
Right, which is beautiful.
And this is first time on foreign soil. Well, first time in Europe.
And the first time really on my own, because even in the Army, you know, you're crawling under machine gun fire and all of that. But you're not on your own. That sergeant or corporal is right there. You have no...
Right.
You know, you do what you're told, which was good for me. But so here I am in Europe with nobody telling me anything, and it was cold.
Okay.
So I decided to hitchhike down to Paris. While I was hitchhiking through the United States, one guy picked me up. He looked just like Barry Goldwater, who was running for president that year. And if you recall, Kennedy was killed in November of 63, Johnson, the vice president, becomes president, and then the election is the following year, and Johnson's running against Goldwater. So they told me if...
Who told you?
This guy was a trucker I picked up. That's
okay.
The great thing about hitchhiking is you wine growers, truckers, you know, this menage of people that you'd meet, and it was a great way to meet people, especially in foreign countries. But the news was that if I voted for Goldwater, we'd have a land war in Asia. And they were right. I voted for Goldwater, and we had a land war in Asia.
So you caused Vietnam.
Yeah, it's my fault.
By that vote for
that did it.
For Goldwater.
Well, he lost by a couple more than one vote.
But okay, but you voted for him, and we got our war.
Right.
So you're in France. You're in Paris.
You made it to Paris. And I hear about the cocktail party at the embassy celebrating Lyndon Johnson's election. And when I traveled, I decided early on that I would take a suit coat with me and a tie, and I carried a valise, not a backpack, so I could get into places that some poor student couldn't get into. And so I snuck into the Paris embassy cocktail party.
So that's interesting. You know, you said you brought a coat and you're dressed well and you didn't have a backpack. You know, when I think of the Euro trips that kids these days do, so to speak, is, you know, they're just got the backpack and they're bumming around Europe. And in essence, that's what you were doing.
Right.
But you were doing it with some style.
Right.
And it sounds like there were people back then, I guess flower children or whatever.
Not quite then, but most of the people were traveling exactly like you're saying. They got one pair of jeans and a backpack.
Flip-flops. And
probably have about the same amount of money or even more than I did. But it was, and as we go on with this discussion, I'll talk about other things that I was able to do like our immediate past president,
right,
who gets into the Academy Awards and God knows what every once in a while.
Yeah, I mean, if you're dressed right, you can get a lot of places.
If you act like you belong there.
That's so you snuck into this embassy cocktail party in Paris.
Full of diplomats.
Celebrating Lyndon Johnson's
election. I didn't tell him who I voted for.
I mean, yeah, sure. So you're in the cocktail party. Tell us about that.
Oh, it was just very impressive for a 21-year-old kid who had never been to Europe. There's all these diplomats from all over the world. And, of course, France has a lot of old colonies from Africa. So they had these very distinguished gentlemen in tuxedos, and some of them with scars on their face, tribal scars.
Oh, wow.
In a tuxedo, you know. And they're now diplomats in Paris. But it was still cold. So I decided to go to Spain because I heard that was warmer.
Just keep going south.
And I got to Spain, and it was, Madrid could be cold in the winter. Now it's, I guess, November, and it's getting cold there, too. But I met some students there, had an interesting time with other students. Francisco Franco was still in power. He's the one that defeated the Republicans in the Spanish Civil War, where Hemingway and the book For Whom the Bells Toll is written about that.
So incident. This is Franco's the dictator,
and he's still there. He's still in power, but he's getting old.
Yeah,
and he's thinking about a transition.
This is in 64. He was still in power,
right?
And he's still old.
And he didn't leave until about 5 years later. But so I'm in the Plaza Mayor, the major plaza in Madrid, and fueled by untold number of pitchers of sangria. And me and a bunch of Spanish students are talking about what's going to happen to Spain. And this is all in Spanish, of course. And my Spanish was passable, but not good. It's better, much better now. But they were really helpful. And they're my age, and they kind of helped me out. And we were up until 2:30 or 3 in the morning.
But this was a really pivotal point in Spain's history, right?
Right.
And you were there talking to those
talking
students
to them
about
that. And, of course, you've got to remember that in those years, we were really looked up to. We just saved everybody's bacon in the Second World War. I mean, that the entire continent was run over by the Nazis.
Right.
If England hadn't held out, I don't know if we would have won that war.
Yeah.
But anyway, so they were kind of looking for what does an American think about this, and how's this democracy stuff work, and well, maybe we're not quite ready for that, and I don't think they were really. So to make a long story short, they did end up with a constitutional monarchy. Juan Carlos became king, I think, in 74. And, of course, they had a prime minister and the same system they have now.
But just like there is today, you're in a square getting drunk with students talking about the future of a country.
Right.
But you were talking about it, you know, I guess you never really know if you're at that pivot point, right? But that was a pivot point, or right before a pivot
point.
And
he ran that country with an iron fist. There were Federalistas, I think is what they called them, the guys with the little black patent leather hats. They were all over the place.
Yeah.
And so these students couldn't get too much out of line. There weren't any riots or anything like that going on.
Huh.
But they were, you know, naturally interested in what's going to happen after this. It was a pretty repressive regime from 39 or whenever he officially took over.
Yeah.
And if you recall, the Russians were on the Republican side, bringing in tanks and armor and advisors, and the Nazis were on Franco's side, bringing in tanks. And
this is middle of the Cold War.
Right.
Like, this is as hot as the Cold War.
Cold War. Eisenhower had done a good job of keeping us out of a nuclear war. Kennedy had just taken over. Now we had Johnson. But it was, you know, Khrushchev died when I was on this trip, and you know what he thought of us. So it was right in the middle of the Cold War.
Wow. So where did you go from Madrid?
Kept going south and heard about this place called Morocco, and it's supposed to be warm there. So I got my yellow fever shots in Malaga and what I needed to do to get in there. I checked with the Algerian embassy, and my plan was to hitchhike from Morocco to Egypt. So I'd go Morocco, Algeria.
So you went to Morocco first. You spent some time in Morocco. You crossed it like the Strait of Gibraltar?
Right.
Right, around there.
I went from Algeciras, which is a Spanish port, to Ceuta, which is also a Spanish port in Africa, a little cutout of Morocco. and then went to Rabat, Tangiers. Rabat's the capital.
What do you think of Tangiers? How was it then?
It's kind of a border city, you know, but the architecture was amazing. Much more interesting, just like Mexico. You know, Tijuana isn't Mexico, in my opinion.
So it's like the Tijuana of Europe.
Yeah, well.
That's Tangiers.
Yeah, it was a pretty scudsy place in a way.
But you were on the cheap. So, you know, I think you mentioned at some point that you lived in the Medinas a lot.
Yeah, I lived in the Arab Quarter for $1 a day. That's food and room.
So in Tangiers, like, what does that mean to live in the Medina? You like, they just had rooms or hostels or what?
Well, most of these North African cities have the Medina. In the old movies, they call them the Kasbah. Mm-hmm. And the Europeans all live up on the hill in these big homes. Mm-hmm. And then the peasants that do all the work, the poor people, live in these little rabbit hutch kind of setups with these streets that are, you know, not much wider than right. that. If a camel comes by, you're in trouble. You know, donkey, you can make it both ways.
Huh.
So I would just get a room there and stay, and you'd come into a restaurant, and Moroccan food is wonderful. And every time I've had it since, it's always good. But they would sit down the bowls, and it's communal eating, and you eat with your right hand.
Yeah. Not in coronavirus times, right?
No.
You imagine everybody sticking their hand into a bowl.
In the same bowl.
And there
were three or four bowls, so you got your fingers in a lot of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
The food was delicious, and I'd get to talk to a few Arabs. I mean, some of them in Morocco, for example, they speak a little French, and I spoke enough French to kind of halfway communicate. But
Now, so I'm interested about this, because, you know, my generation, I guess, you know, the Arabs in the United States don't get along very well.
Right.
I would say that's maybe a little bit of an understatement. But a very adversarial relationship, I think, between the United States and the Arab world in general.
Well, it depends on who it is.
It's generalization.
Yeah.
But what was your experience, we'll say, in like Tangier?
And in Morocco, we were fine. Now, remember, we threw the Nazis out of North Africa.
Yeah.
Us and the British. So I would actually, when I hitchhiked, I would put a little American flag and I'd stitch it on the outside of my valise, and that would be right in front. And that meant to somebody, well, this guy isn't just some French student. We know all about French students. This is an American.
Forget about that.
So, and there's a big French influence. So they were down there growing grapes. Frenchmen would, and I got picked up one day by a guy who owned a winery and spoke pretty good English. And again, it's a great way to see a place.
And
every once in a while, they'd stop at their house or something and pick up something or invite me to lunch, or we'd stop somewhere.
Do you ever get mistaken for a French? For a French person? A Frenchman?
No, if I opened my mouth, I wouldn't.
Right, right.
And they could tell
just
by looking.
But I mean, I think, like, here's your passport photo. Let's pop up his passport photo. This is a passport photo from, look at that guy. Yeah, I don't think you look French at all. And that's this passport right here, right?
Right.
We have this. This is amazing. This is a passport from your travels. And they don't even look like this anymore, huh? Different shape, different size, but quite a few stamps in that bad boy. That's pretty cool. And then what's this?
That's a journal I wrote. Started in Canada and kept it up, kind of, you know, interspersed. It's written in longhand, but I read through it in the last few days. I haven't read it in 20 years. And I was a history and philosophy major at UCLA. And so I was into ideas and types of government.
I'm going to try to get this.
It was really interesting to read. You know, maybe you can even open it up. You can see the terrible scrawl in there. Here's what I'm thinking 55 years ago. Here's what I'm thinking about socialism. Here's what I'm thinking about Russia, you know, Morocco, Egypt. Nasser was in Egypt.
Out of focus, but still pretty cool.
Whatever.
Yeah. That's
But
so
I
awesome.
Would recommend young people traveling today or club members. It's, you know, you think you're going to remember all this stuff, and I'm amazed that I do remember most of it.
As you were reading through it, did you read some stuff and be like, man, that's some horse shit that I wrote back then?
Yeah, because I was 21 years old. And of course, you know, there's an old saying that Mark Twain said about, you know, when I was 16, my dad didn't know anything. I was amazed by the time I turned 22 how much he had learned. So I was on the cusp of starting to get, after I got off this trip, I didn't think I was that sophisticated, but I'd seen more than most people already.
So there's some pretty grandiose thoughts in there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Winston Churchill said, you know, if when you're 22, if you don't want to save the world and give all your money away to all the poor people and everything, then you don't have a heart. Mm-hmm. But if you're 45 and you still want to give all your money away to all these people that don't have a job and don't want to work, then you don't have a brain. So there's some of that going on. I think young people are naturally very altruistic, which is good.
Yeah.
It's healthy.
Of course.
Normal.
So we left off, you're staying in a Medina in Tangier.
Right.
And you're traveling around Morocco.
Right.
You went to, where else did you go in Morocco? All the places?
I went to, from Tangiers, I went to Rabat. I saw the king of Morocco.
What do you mean
Mohammed,
you saw the king?
He was at a parade.
Oh, I thought you sneuck into a.
Oh, no, I didn't sneak into
like
his
that.
House. I might have ended up with no toes or something. But I saw him in person. I was probably 30 feet away from him. And they had one of these great Arab charges where they come charging right at you with their guns and the horses, and they stop like 3 feet. They just go thunk. And anyway, that's Mohammed V. His son, Mohammed VI, is still on the throne in Morocco today. So there's a little bit of history. Morocco was very well run, a nice place, safe, I think. And I think it still is. I haven't been back, but I'd love to go again. So now I'm on my way to Algeria. I had the brains to go to the Algerian embassy in Madrid and ask them if I need a visa. Oh, no, sir. No problem, senor. So I take a train into Algeria, and the Algerian Civil War had only been over about a year and a half. Remember, De Gaulle, that was his last outpost in North Africa, and they held it tenaciously and finally gave up. Ben Bella was the guy who took over the rebels. So the borders were all Uzis, and you know, they're still nervous.
Yeah.
And I get there, and they go, oh, senor, or monsieur, you can't come into this country. You don't have a visa. I said, they told me I didn't need a visa. Oh, you know, you have to have a visa. You'll have to go back to Morocco. So I went back and kind of wiggled around in the train station. This was in Oujda, which is right on the border between Morocco and Algeria. And then I snuck back on the train. And then I locked myself in the men's room. And then the guys with the Uzis came by and were banging on doors and banging on them. And they just kept banging, and I didn't.
How long did that last?
About 5 or 7 minutes.
No, not very tenacious.
Well,
I feel like borders are a little bit more locked down these days.
They were holding the whole train up with all these hundreds of people on it. The train's on its way to Oran, which is the big port city, and I went there in Algeria. So anyway, I got through.
Okay, so you snuck through in a bathroom on a train.
And when we're going over the hills, I actually saw children with distended bellies. There were still starvation going on.
And this is Algeria?
Yeah.
Right after?
Because of the war. Yeah, because of the war. And went to Oran. Oran is where they, right outside of Oran, I think, is where the Brits had to sink the French Navy because they were afraid that they succumbed to Hitler, they were going to give their whole Navy to the Nazis. So it was sank right there in the harbor. The French wouldn't give up the Vichy government, and they sunk it. So then it went on to Algiers, spent some time there, still pockmarked 50 caliber machine gun shells in the buildings from the war. They hadn't fixed all of that yet. And ended up finding out that not only could I not get in without a visa, I needed a visa to get out. You need an exit visa. So I went down to the prefecture, which is like the police.
Having snuck in,
now I can't sneak out. And as I recall, I ended up hanging around there for about 3 days. I don't know if I snuck on the boat or not. I think I actually did get a visa, an exit visa. But now my funds are running low.
And the way how much did you have left?
At that point in time, I had $40.
$40, and you just got your exit visa.
And I'm going to go to Marseille.
Okay.
And then I'd written my dad, this is how it worked. I had written him and told him to mail $200 to Cairo. So there was $200 in the American Express office in Cairo, which I wasn't going to make on $16. And
you were going to Marseille.
I was going to Marseille because I told him to send $200 to Rome.
Oh, okay.
So when I landed in Marseille after paying my passage, deck passage, across a terrible storm in the Mediterranean, I had $16 in my pocket and I had to make it all the way from Marseille to Rome. And I did.
Did you get skinny?
Yeah, I was skinnier than I am now, for sure.
So to Marseille, aboard like a very choppy seas.
Yeah.
And you wound up making it to Rome, but you had $16 between Marseille and Rome. So how did you make it to Rome?
Slept in cars outside of Avignon, you know.
Wait, what do you mean slept in cars?
Abandoned cars, old truck or something. I just climbed under there.
Wait, there'd be like abandoned cars on the side of the road? Like how common was that?
In farming areas, sure. It's, you know, in this country, you still see old abandoned cars all around.
So you just hop in one of those? You ever run into some farmer run you out?
Nope. People were, I think probably because of my age, most of the locals were always very gracious. And I don't know if that book came out before I took this trip or not. There was a book called The Ugly American. Maybe it was later. But we didn't have a real good image abroad. And I made a point of just being as gracious as I could be to everybody I met because I had the flag and they knew I was an American. And I figured I was, and I think we all are today. We're ambassadors.
But it sounds like a lot of Europe felt like they owed us for World War II to a certain extent.
Except for the French.
But then that kind of led, that might have led to some people, you know, abusing that goodwill and, you know.
We rebuilt Europe. We did a lot to tear it down, but the Marshall
At this point,
plan,
I think we've
it.
Used up that goodwill.
Yeah. Yeah, we had about by then. It had been 15 years and it had. Yeah.
Well, I mean, now 2020, I think that goodwill's.
Oh, it's long gone.
Yeah, it's long gone.
They don't, the average student in Europe, I don't think they know that, you know, or in this country, they ask who fought in the Second World War and you get this blank stare, you know.
Yeah.
It's scary. Anyway, so.
So you got your $200 in Rome, but yep. You got to get to it first. You slept in some cars and now
Christmas is coming up and it snows.
Oh.
And I think we've got a photo here of St. Peter's Square. The Pope comes out on Christmas Eve and blesses the masses, about 8,000 people in St. Peter's Square. You could hear a pin drop.
So you got to Rome. You got to see Rome in the snow. That must have been amazing.
That was cool. I think it's only done it two or three times since then. So.
Wow. So it doesn't snow often, but it does sometimes, and sometimes it covers.
So that was cool, and then going through the Vatican Museum and Sistine Chapel and
St. Peter's Basilica. There.
All that stuff is just amazing, you know.
Yeah, that's amazing. And that Christmas tree is not flocked; it's
that's real snow.
It's real snow. Wow.
But
you're replenished at that point. You've got your $200, so you're
I'm a rich man.
Yeah, you're a rich man.
Still want to travel more, and now I've got $200 in Cairo, so that's the goal. I met a Australian nurse in Rome, and we decided to travel together for a while, and we went down to Naples and saw Pompeii and all of Naples has to offer. Italy's just an amazing place. Before I left Rome, I did go up to Florence and Venice, and those were just amazing places. As a student, I could eat for 25 cents at the student mensa, the cafeteria.
Mm-hmm.
That included two entrees, wine, pasta.
Wow.
For 25 cents. So you could be budget conscious. Anyway, from there, on the way to Greece, hitched over to Brindisi, which is right on the heel of the boot. I think you've said you'd been there. And
I remember Brindisi had a really cool, not a Medina, but what do they call it in Italy?
In Italy.
When the city center, the very dense city center.
Yeah. Well, just the old section of the city.
Yeah, the old,
with narrow.
I remember seeing a lot of people, a lot of old grandmothers out in the street, you know, sitting on a stool, and they were rolling the pasta.
Yeah.
You know, them making the different
with their
shapes.
Black socks and their and black shawls.
Yeah. And they're just sitting there, like, knocking out those little pasta things all day. I thought that was
food
so cool.
was great. You said I was skinny, but when I got out of Italy, I'd gained some pounds there.
So Brindisi's a port city, so it sounds like you were off again on another
well, another we caught the boat, I think, in Bari, which is very near Brindisi. And the boat went, it was kind of a ferry, but a nicer ferry. It goes from Italy through the Aegean Sea, and you end up in Corfu, which is in Greece. Mm-hmm. And then we took the canal that the Germans had built when the Nazis were in Greece that kind of cuts off the Peloponnese. Peloponnese is south, and you used to have to sail all the way around until they cut this canal through. Mm-hmm. So we went through that canal. That was interesting. And then landed in Piraeus Harbor. That's the harbor of Athens. And it just so happens I'd seen the Pope in Rome. And here is the Coptic Archbishop throwing a golden cross into the harbor, and all these boys are diving for the golden cross, which is a great honor. And the Coptic Church, or the Orthodox Church, Coptic actually means Egyptian in Greek, but the Orthodox Church there, Epiphany is a bigger day than Christmas. That's when the three wise men.
So I think we have a picture of this. Not a great picture, but this is the
yeah.
Well, this is the guy that got
they're wiggling
the golden
a lot,
cross
yeah.
that he's holding up. He got it.
Yeah, that's not my photo. We just my photos are in my garage somewhere, and we don't know where they are. But anyway, these are
so they throw this. Was it an actual relic that they would throw into the harbor?
I don't know.
Or was it? Like
I don't know. It was just a cool thing to see. It was like a big part
so
of.
So when you
calendar.
Showed up on the boat, that was going on.
Yeah, that's going cool. on. It was just luck. And we went and stayed at a place called Lily's, which was this little hotel in the middle of Athens, and went to the Parthenon and all of those.
What was Athens like then?
Athens is a big city. They had some stuff going on. The prime minister was named Pompidou, and he was thrown out of office by the army about 2 years after I left. So there were riots, and you know
there were riots in Athens while you were there.
Yeah, that'd been going on since Once the Nazis were there, you had the communists, and then the Nazis, and all these different factions.
How did you participate in these riots?
I didn't.
You had to have watched. Well, you're a 20-year-old, 21-year-old red-blooded American male. You're not going to go out and...
No, I'm not going to go march because I didn't know what the hell was going on.
Throw a bottle of Ouzo at someone?
I did that.
Okay.
Ouzo too much.
You did participate. Yeah, you throw the full bottle of Ouzo, not an empty one. That stuff's gross.
Well, they also had wine there. This is a good story. And they have this white wine that's called Retsina, and it has this funny flavor. It tastes a little bit like turpentine, and what it is pine pitch sap that they put in the wine. And the reason they did this, so the story goes, is the Germans were coming by and drinking all their white wine, because Germans love white wine, Rhine mm-hmm. wines, you know. And so they started putting this pitch in the wine, the Germans wouldn't drink it anymore.
Yeah.
And then they developed a taste for it. So they like it now. They still make it. And I didn't like it at all, so I got to, and I always learn a few words in whatever country I was in, and I learned the word for wine, which is Kasi, and the word for black, which is Mavro, and that meant, you know, dark red wine without pitch in it. Hmm. And so that's what I would buy when we were there, maybe, I don't know, 5 drachma, which is about 25 cents or something.
So climbed all over the Parthenon.
Saw all the sights, and then took a boat out. I'm still with the Australian nurse. Her name was Sue, and she was from Melbourne, if you're watching.
Sue from Melbourne.
Yeah. But anyway, she was a nice gal. But anyway, we decided to go out to one of the islands, a little island called Poros, because it was very close. Mm-hmm. But it really gave you a good feel for what a Greek island was like, and we hiked up to the monastery on top of the hill, and they took us in and fed us lunch, and... You know, they're very gracious people. And I was reading as I was traveling, I was reading Zorba the Greek by Kazantzakis. I don't know if you know the movie with Anthony Quinn, but the book was really done well. And it gave you a good feeling for the culture and where these people were coming from. So that was interesting.
Yeah. So that was Poros or Paros? P-A?
There's two different ones. One is Paros. This one is Poros. P-O-R-O-S. It's only probably an hour by ferry out
ferry
of
ride.
Poros. Yeah.
So where did you go after that? Was that
we came back, and I couldn't afford a lot of ferry rides, you know.
Right.
So this was the way we traveled. But took another boat because it wasn't easy to do. And we're getting in a part of the world where people don't have cars. The government has cars, but people don't. So hitchhiking becomes more difficult. So we took a boat to Izmir, Turkey, which is right near Ephesus. If you had a map of Turkey, here's Istanbul, here's Ankara, here's the coast, and here is Izmir, Turkey, is right here. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of Roman ruins here. Ephesus is right north of Izmir. And we show up there, and it's Ramadan.
Huh.
Fasting season for Muslims, and this nurse was fluent in French, and she managed to get us into two different private homes when they broke the fast two evenings in a row.
Oh, wow.
And the whole discussion was in French, so I was kind of at a loss, but they were very gracious, and it was fun to see, you know, just how this all worked. So I'd been to, you know, Catholic Christmas, Orthodox Epiphany, and now we're at Ramadan. Hmm. I didn't even know what Ramadan was when I took
you really trip. Lucked out on this trip, huh?
Yeah, I did. We're just kind of serendipitously, we'd be there and something would, like seeing the king in Morocco, you know, it just happened.
Right.
So, and
you ever have any bad luck on this trip? You ever getting into any trouble?
The only two times I got in trouble, and we chatted about a little bit before, was once in a nightclub in Izmir, where I was probably out of line because they just wanted to sell me watered down drinks. And anyway,
having those watered down drinks.
I wasn't doing very well. And make a long story short, there was were words and an altercation, and I ended up getting chased down an alley by about three Turks with knives in their hands. So, but I was pretty fast in those days.
Yeah, so it wasn't a dead end alley, right? You got
Thank
away.
Thank God it wasn't.
Yeah. Okay. Now, what kind of shoes were you wearing? Because I think I saw a picture of you like in sandals or something, or like a Birkenstock.
No, that wasn't me. That was just a photo that we had.
That was some hippie.
I would just I wouldn't wear sneakers either. I'd wear regular shoes that would fit up with the whole.
But you could still run in them.
Yeah, I could still run, and I was 21. You know,
yeah,
it was a great shape. So after that, we went to Istanbul, which is an amazing place, and I think he's shown some of the Hagia Sophia, the old Christian church. Constantine had it, and when the Turks took over in 1100 AD or whenever it was, the Ottoman Empire,
is that it there?
Yeah, that's it there. They put those spires up, and then it's now a mosque.
Yeah.
But an amazing piece of architecture, regardless of which religion's running it. And
who was running it at the time?
The Turks. And so the Ottoman Empire took it over, and when the Ottoman Empire crumbled after the First World War, then Otto Turk came in, who was their dictator, and basically Turkey's a fairly liberal...
Otto Turk's different than the Mechanical Turk, right?
Yeah, right.
A little bit of automation joke there. Sorry.
But anyway, it was an amazing place, too. The nurse and I had differences on what was an acceptable place to stay. She wanted a place with clean sheets and no bugs, and I didn't want dirty sheets and bugs, but my budget...
But an abandoned auto would do on the side of the road for you.
Yeah,
so.
That was fine with me, yeah.
Yeah, I think traveling with women, you do have to have clean sheets.
We do. And, like when I travel, I travel all through the United States now, and my wife will meet me once in a while. She'll fly to New Orleans or something, and I'll travel with her. Well, the price of the hotels suddenly goes like this. We're staying in these old plantations, you know, and then it's down to Motel 6 again after she leaves. So, anyway, we part as friends, and Istanbul, and I hitched to Rabat, which is the capital, up very high in the mountains, and it's snowing there, cold, California boy again. So I start heading south again. I end up on a bus. I get sick because I've been eating the way I didn't speak any Turkish, and nobody in those days in Turkey spoke anything else, maybe a little French, but that was it.
Mm-hmm.
So the way you'd order is they'd just take you in the back and you'd go that one and this one and this one. And that's the way we ate, which was good food, but their bugs I wasn't used to yet, whatever they have. So I had a form of dysentery. I was pretty sick on the bus. They dropped me off in front of a U.S. air base right outside of Adana, Turkey, southern Turkey. It's called Isirlik. Mm-hmm. And these are Air Force guys. Mm-hmm. When I was in the Army, I was a company clerk. Mm-hmm. So I gave all the officers their passes. I did the daily report. I kind of knew the lingo. I ended up driving for a two-star general who was in the 63rd Infantry Division at one of the summer camps. So I kind of knew the lingo. So I passed myself off, again, as a second lieutenant from a tank battalion in Germany.
Right? And they just didn't ask as many questions back then, huh?
Sixth Army and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah, sure. Come on board, sir. No problem.
And they didn't have a clue.
Good to have you.
So they set me up with the bachelor's, the BOQ, bachelor's.
And you're just like, oh, yeah, I totally lost my military ID and, you know.
Well, they never even asked. It was amazing, you know.
Yeah.
Because, you know, those bases where we were sending U-2s into at that time.
Right.
U-2s into spy on
Russia. Yeah, this is the height of the Cold War.
Right.
And I'll say, you don't look like a Frenchman. You could be a Russian.
Oh, I could pass for an American, though.
Yeah, but you could have been a Russian, too.
Well, that's true. But they weren't watching. So anyway, spent about awesome. 3 days there, and I'd go drink with the junior officers, met the post commander, the colonel, as I recall, one day. And this is Quist from, Lieutenant Quist from Germany.
Whole base. Sir.
Yes, sir.
Rob Quist infiltrates a base in Turkey.
So about 3 days of drinking good booze and hamburgers and peanut butter and all the stuff I had to had, I was fit.
They put you up in the BOQ and, you know, officers, you know, O Club and everything.
Right,
huh?
Right.
Cool, yeah. Air Force on top of it. Sorry, I just can't get over that.
Well, Barry Goldwater had been a major general in the Air Force. So. Yeah. From there, I'm still got this wanderlust and I've got to get down to my $200 in Cairo, so I hitched.
Oh yeah, the last time you were resupplied,
was in Rome. Yeah.
Yeah, we've been so many places since.
$200.
Yeah, $200. $200 through all of Italy,
boats.
Rome, Greece, Turkey.
Right. And less than $200.
So how much do you have at that point?
I don't know. Enough.
Okay,
I
mean, so you have enough to get you from Turkey.
Well, I had to go through Syria, which was a Uzis again. It was a mess.
How was Syria back then?
It was just like it is. Well, now it's even worse. But then it was full of machine gun toting nasty guards at the border. Mm-hmm. And what are you here for? And I'm an American. And they didn't like that. The Ba'athist Party had just taken over. And this idiot that they've got in there now is the dictator of Syria. That's the same party and his father. Hmm. And didn't spend much time there. It's unfortunate because there were some great sites there, but I just didn't like the atmosphere. So I went on to Lebanon. When I get into Beirut, Lebanon, it is like Switzerland. I mean, the hills are green and beautiful. There's these Scandinavian gals driving around in Mercedes-Benz convertibles. And it's the capital of Lebanon, and it's where the Arab sheikhs from all over the other Arab countries that are very repressive could go and drink, gamble, and fool around with Scandinavian girls.
Super westernized.
Yeah, big banks. Everything was clean. The American embassy was right on the bay, and he probably got some pictures of just the color of the water there. It was just beautiful. And this was before the Marine barracks got bombed there when Reagan was president, so that's in the 80s later.
Is that Lebanon?
Yep, that's one of the squares in Lebanon.
Wow.
In those days, that's an old picture, I think.
There's a lot of cars.
If you look at those cars, they're all most of them are old Mercedes-Benzes.
Yeah, like the 60s. You don't really see that many cars, and wow.
But it was a megalopolis. It was a great place. I met a lot of, and they had a great system there. The head of the country was a Muslim. The second in command was a Christian, Orthodox Christian. Then they had what they called Druids, mm-hmm. and they had a position in the government. So they had all these little, like five different religions, all had their, you know, I'm the second VP and whatever. And the country worked. They lived together. They even had Jews.
For a little bit, right?
Yeah. Well, and they got along, and the place was just lovely until that broke down and it became a sectarian mess. And
well, it was a good while it lasted, huh?
Yeah, and and great food, Lebanese food. So took the only way I could get to Egypt from there was to take a boat because you couldn't cross into the next country, Israel. Either way, you couldn't go from Israel to Lebanon, or you couldn't go from Lebanon to Israel.
They wouldn't let you in, even though
they didn't care who you
even
were.
Second Lieutenant Quist.
No, Second Lieutenant, even General Quist couldn't have got through. So ended up in Port Said, which is right on the eastern end of the Suez Canal. It's in Egypt, and it's in the Sinai. And then I think I hitchhiked to Alexandria, and then took a train to Cairo. And I'm staying, and now it's February, and now I finally, this California boy finally found the place. You know, it's February, right. It's not hot, it's not cold, it's just
this
perfect.
Is the spot.
And Cairo is kind of a big, ugly city, or at least it was 55 years ago. I don't think, from what I've heard of friends, that it's gotten that much better.
You get to crawl around on the pyramids?
Yes, yeah, and you don't crawl because the covering, which made them so smooth, and now there's these big granite boulders, you know, they're like 3 feet high, so it's tough walking up there. But yeah, when you get the top of the big pyramid in Giza, there's graffiti and Greek, Arabic, Sanskrit. I mean, people have been going there for thousands of years, and when they get up there, they...
I don't think you can climb them anymore.
I don't think you can either.
Yeah.
But you could in those days.
So cool.
And you could go to all of the... any of the sites for free, because you're a student. You just show them your student ID, even though it's from UCLA. No problem. Come right in. So I spent almost a whole month there.
Wow.
Met a Swede, and my name is Swedish. About a quarter Swedish, I guess. And he was working for NATO, and he had a car, and we became fast friends. And so I played tennis with him at the Niall Hilton on the clay courts with ball boys and all of that, and hung out together. So I wasn't posing as anything. I was just a friend of the...
You really did this in style, didn't you?
He was a captain, yeah.
Yeah.
Big wheel.
Yeah.
But he was not much older than me, maybe 25 or 6.
So where do you go from Cairo?
Cairo, you go to Luxor. That's the Valley of the Thieves.
So you went down the Nile.
The Valley of the Kings, yeah.
And how'd you get down the Nile?
I took a boat. Well, no, I took the train... And I did, I think, took a boat on the way back.
Okay.
But, and you, if you went further, you would be at Abu Simbel. The Russians were building this giant dam over the Nile.
That's the Aswan Dam.
Right.
And that wasn't built when you went there.
They were building it.
So the flow was already
and
diverted.
And if you look in this passport, you've got a picture of Ramses II before he would have been underwater. Those big colossus statues.
Yeah.
They would have been 40 feet underwater, but they raised them before the water raised.
Really?
And I didn't go down there. It was too expensive. And really, the sites are in the Temple of Karnak, King Tut's tomb, Queen Hatshepsut's beautiful palace, all on the Nile. Just tremendous sites. It is a great place. I'd really, and I think it's safe even today.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just spectacular. And I learned so much, and of course, again, I'm 21 years old, I don't know anything, so I'm just sopping all these cultures up and loving every bit of it.
Wow, what an experience.
Yeah.
So where'd you go from Egypt?
From Egypt, I...
Guys, this is not over yet. We've got places
going
to go. We're in Egypt? How much money do you think you have left at that point?
Well, I have $200.
You always have $200.
No, but I haven't spent much at all, because I'm staying in the... in the youth hostel in Cairo,
right.
And the youth hostel in...
I'm keeping track, you got $200 in Paris? No, you came with that money.
No, I don't think I got any money in Paris. I had money with me. I didn't get any money until I got to Rome.
So Rome and then Cairo. So you spent $400 so far.
$600. Plus I had the money I had with me, which is probably another $350 or something, whatever.
All right, so where'd you go from Cairo?
I caught a Russian ship that was going to Piraeus, back to Greece, because I had a friend that was coming into Northern Europe, a girlfriend, and she was going to fly into Luxembourg in a month and a half or so, so I needed to get back up north. But on the Russian ships in those days, or their planes too, but they had the most beautiful stewardesses, the boats are immaculate, the food is excellent, everything is perfect. And I don't know where they got all
this
those beautiful Russian girls.
This is for the ferry between Cairo
And Piraeus.
Piraeus.
And what it is a big facade to show the world, this is the way communism works.
Look at the USSR.
Look at
this.
Yeah, look at how
look
great
at our
we are.
Ferries. If our ferries are this nice.
So I buy the...
They're probably running the same ferry these days.
Maybe.
Probably with the same stewardesses.
Maybe. Anyway, I go in his deck passage, put my coat on, my tie, and went up to the first class lounge and hung out for 2 days. And they
just walked in, huh?
Yeah. They finally caught me about 2 hours before we docked, but that was fine with me.
I want to stand out on the deck anyway. This is the perfect time to be on the deck.
So then ended up in Greece again. I'd already been to Athens, went back to Lily's Pension. I wonder if it's still there. And full of young people. And then I hitchhiked up to Thessalonica, sometimes called Thessaloniki. And it's it's on the coast as you go up to Turkey on the eastern coast of Greece, mm-hmm. okay? And then north of there is Yugoslavia and Albania and Bulgaria. So I hear some guys in the train station speaking Spanish, but it's a strange Spanish. And it just sounded different, but I could kind of understand every three words or so. So I ended up talking to these guys. Well, they were speaking 15th century Spanish. It's called Ladrino. And what they were the descendants of the Jews who were thrown out of Spain in 1492.
Hmm.
And so they kept this language. They were dispersed all over the Mediterranean. There's about a little over 100,000 people that still speak this language. It's written with Hebrew characters.
Huh.
And it has some Hebrew words in it, but basically it's 15th century Spanish. So he takes me home for lunch, and I meet his mother and his dad and the family, and they speak this 15th century Spanish at our lunch. They speak Hebrew at the synagogue, and then, of course, they speak Greek at their normal jobs.
Huh.
And so that was kind of an interesting...
And where were they living? What area?
In Thessalonica. I don't remember the exact area. They had a, you know... By Greek standards, a nice house, and they were very nice people, very gracious. And of course, the other thing is, you say you get into somebody's house like this, they're just as curious about you in America as you are curious about them and the country they're in.
Right.
And if you can capitalize on that, and when you're 21, you can. At my age, that's much more difficult to do because they figure this guy's got some money and, you know,
yeah.
Let's work on that a little bit. And they take one look at me, even with my, I mean, this jacket was not the best in the world, but it was good enough to sneak into places with. But they knew I wasn't rich, you know.
Yeah.
So from there, I've got to get through Yugoslavia to get to Europe. And I wanted to go skiing. I'd never been skiing. And I figure I'd go to where they had the Winter Olympics in 1960, Innsbruck. Austria.
Not a bad place to go skiing, arguably.
But I've got to get through Yugoslavia, and you can't hitchhike in Yugoslavia because there are no cars. There's no private cars.
And they have like the Yugo or something, or that?
Nope, they had nothing because it was a communist country. Tito was still in power. He was a partisan that fought during the Second World War.
Yeah.
And kept that whole place together, Serbia, Croatia, and Kosovo, and all of those disparate parts that are now all separate countries.
Right.
He managed to keep that place running and together, but it was pretty dismal. It was very interesting. Right in the middle of Cold War, here I'm in downtown Belgrade, looking at these big, beautiful, wide streets, not a car on them, maybe a government trucker here or there. Then these big windows, shopping windows and department stores, there's nothing in the window. And if you look in the store, there's not much in there, too, a couple of T-shirts and...
Jeez.
So they were very Spartan living for these people.
You should have sold some of your clothes. Sold some jeans or something.
I only had one coat. I needed it.
Yeah, you need to get into places to sneak into first class.
So I end up in Innsbruck after going through Yugoslavia, which was fun. I've never been on the Dalmatian coast. I'd love to go back there. That's the Adriatic, you know, side of it. And... I meet a guy, his name is Barkley from USC, who I'd met before, and in the journal I mentioned where I met him, and I've forgotten now.
You instantly got into a fight.
No.
You said USC. Weren't you UCLA?
Yeah, but no, I had friends. In fact, he was a fraternity brother. I think he was in the Tri-Delts at SC, and I knew a guy Bart Christensen, who was in that fraternity. Anyway, well, he did do a pretty nasty thing. He said, oh, Rob, you want to go ski? You've never been skiing, huh? You don't know anything about skiing? No, no. Okay, we'll set you up. So they rented me the skis, and they take me up to the top of the lift, and they dump me off on the women's slalom Olympic. You know, it's like this.
Yeah.
And that was my first ski run.
First ski run, women's Olympic slalom in Innsbruck.
Right, and I'm going down like this. Like I look like Wile E. Coyote, you know?
Right. You made it to the bottom, though.
I made it to the bottom with many bruises and sores.
But you got to go skiing.
Yeah, it was fun.
That's nice.
And I did end up taking that sport up, and my wife and I were when we were younger, and before I had...
I heard you got into some trouble in Austria, too. Was this with the USC guy?
No, this was with a guy from Wyoming who was... we got liquored up in a bar and decided, well, the back door's right there, and we owe a ton of money to this guy. How about if we just kind of roll out of this place? This is our two drunks are talking, you know?
Yeah.
So we do, and we go back to the youth hostel. You know, where are they going to look for an American?
Right, right.
And so they ended, I heard them coming, and I slipped out the back door of the youth hostel, and I found out later that they got a hold of him, and you don't want to get in a hassle with an Austrian cop in those days.
Yeah.
They thumped him around a little bit.
Yeah, so they just beat him up. Did he have to pay the bar tab? He had to pay your bar tab?
Nope.
No?
He didn't have enough money, and neither did I don't think. And they didn't know where I was. I was gone. I was on my way to Vienna by then.
So you bounce out with your suitcase,
yep.
Apparently.
And my coat.
And your coat.
And my...
Never to go back to that youth hostel again.
Right.
You know what bar it is, just in case, you know, one day they're going to watch and be like,
I doubt if I
Rob
can find
Quist.
It. Yeah, they're still looking. Here's the tab.
Your picture's on the wall of that bar. Never again.
So, again.
So you're off to
the only other time
point.
I was in trouble, it was my fault. I was out of line. And other than that, this whole trip, never had a problem, even though I'm getting into cars and strangers and... Not yeah. a problem in the world.
So the only time you got in trouble was
my
in a
own
bar or in a nightclub.
In a nightclub, yeah.
You know,
I should have been in there anyway. I couldn't afford to drink in the, you know.
Right, and in a bar. So yeah. So. Andy, did Rob pay for this drink? Or is he going to run out the back door?
No, I got a coat on. I don't have to, right?
You got a dog's collateral.
Yeah. All right, so you're on your way to Vienna at this point, huh?
Yeah, Vienna's beautiful. I remember taking a nap on the beautiful park outside of the Vienna Opera House, and this guy, cop, comes by and thumps me on the bottom of the shoe. Nix schlafen unter Grasen. You can't sleep on the grass. Das ist verboten, you know. So he rousted me out of there. But
that's how you say it, Grasen?
I think Grasen is, yeah. There's probably somebody that speaks decent German. German is a really a tough language, and I can get in trouble in German, but that's about all. But anyway, I remember getting bounced out of there. Very well-run country.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. And now I'm much more into classical music, and I'd just love to go back there. I haven't been back since. So then I'm going north. That doesn't matter.
You're going up to meet this girl.
Yeah.
I met her in
Luxembourg, and I've spent some
time... She flew in the same route that you did.
Yeah, same $99.
$99 DC-3 out of New York.
Yeah, in fact, there was a couple, some friends of ours that were married that were going to come, and they kind of flaked out, but she came alone. So then...
So would you take that flight now? If there was a $99 flight on a DC-3 from New York...
For $18?
For 18 hours.
Hours?
You got to sit on the DC-3 for 18 hours, no. But you only have to pay $99.
No, I just flew to Paris business class for Christmas.
Yeah.
With my whole family.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't do that anymore.
Yeah. Too bad that Concorde never really
Oh, that was
got
a great deal.
That was a quick flight.
4 hours or whatever it was. But
so she flew in the same route, New York to
Luxembourg.
She's
flying the same route, and I'm getting kind of homesick. I've been on the road a while, but...
But you're pretty adept at traveling. You're
right,
traveling
and
pretty
I've got the ropes, you know, because I at the beginning of the trip, the reason I ended up not making it across... I could have made it across North Africa had I been more sophisticated about spending money. I mean, the first night I was in Europe, I think I spent it in a hotel in Brussels. Well, you know, if you're traveling that way, you don't rent hotel rooms. That's stupid,
right.
You know, so... But anyway, so she and I went back to Spain, which was lovely, and it was still warm. And now it's April-ish. And then we went to Portugal, which I had never been to Portugal. Lovely country. Really enjoyed that. And then I guess we went back to France so she could see a little bit of France. And then took a ferry over to England. Hitchhiked all through England up into Scotland. And then...
This sounds like it's going faster, probably because the money's...
Money's getting is tight, and
you got to spend more because
I'm just trying. I'm watching the money, right. And also, quite frankly, I'm 21 years old. I've never been away from home this long,
right?
And it's one thing to be with people, but I was on this whole trip. I'm always alone,
right?
I'm often in countries that I don't speak a word of their language, and they don't speak a word of my language. So you've got to have some fortitude.
And how
to
many,
take a trip
when,
like
when
this.
Did you meet up with this girl? Like how many months into the trip?
Maybe two.
2 months?
Yeah.
So then you guys traveled, because you said it was a 9-month
trip. 2-month trip in those days, that's a pretty good tour, you know.
Yeah, but you said the whole thing was like 9 months, right?
Yeah.
So you spent...
I'd been on my own for 7.
Okay, you'd been on your own for 7.
Right.
And now the last 2 months were
with
this girlfriend.
Yeah.
And you saw basically all of Western Europe.
Right.
At that point.
Exactly. And we didn't go into Switzerland because it was too expensive.
Yeah.
And we didn't go into Holland either for probably the same reason. But England was reasonable in those days. And again, you've got to remember, 55 years ago, the British pounds were $3.60. They're 20 shillings to a pound. That's about 17 cents each. There's 12 pence to a shilling. So just paying for something is complicated, you know, keeping track of that. Every country you go in, they had the common market was in force, meaning not England, but the European countries kind of hooked up together for trade purposes, but it wasn't the common market or the European Union yet.
Right.
So it was kind of this hodgepodge, and every time you approached a border, you had to show your passport and get it stamped and, you know.
Right.
So it was a different kind of traveling.
And lots of currency exchange.
Right. Right, and it's so much simpler now.
Did you lose a lot in the currency exchange? Or
no.
It was pretty much you got the fair rate.
And then sometimes, like in some countries, like in Egypt, you go to the black market and you get double what the banks will give you.
Really?
So the
banks do they charge quite a bit back then.
They charge what the official rate is, but the black market, an Egyptian pound isn't worth that much. So,
yeah.
And the same in Turkey. So we would buy... So I'd go with those U.S. dollars, which they wanted. They want U.S. dollars to stick away in a shoebox somewhere.
Right.
And so they were very valuable. So that's the way we would trade money.
Interesting. So where you so Scotland, the U.K., then what did you guys do?
Went back back to Luxembourg, caught the same flight back again. I'd been on that airplane since then, too.
Yeah.
And 2010, I went to Cuba, and I gave a little talk here at the club about it, and flew on a DC. It was illegal to go.
2010, you flew on a DC-10,
a DC-3
to Cuba.
No, yeah, from from Nassau.
Huh.
Because you couldn't. It was illegal.
Yeah.
Against the Trading with the Enemies Act, I was violating, whatever.
Yeah.
But it was illegal to do that, and so I flew this plane, and it took like an hour to go from Nassau to Havana, and it was noisier than hell. But this was a Russian-made DC-3. So after Hitler attacked Russia, they were in cahoots together. After that happened, then, of course, Britain and the U.S. were giving the Russians, you know, you're fighting Germans, you're our friends, even though you're... You know,
right?
It doesn't matter who you are; you're our friend if you're killing Nazis.
Right.
So we gave them the plans to the DC-3, and they made these airplanes, but they made it in the traditional Russian, you know, like the toilet seats weighs 18 pounds of steel. You know.
So this thing was even slower.
Oh, it's slower and noisy. So noisy you couldn't believe it. You could talk to you and I could be sitting close together, and couldn't hear each other.
Okay, but back to Europe, back to your trip, because this was 2010. That is interesting that they're still flying those DC-3s from Nassau to Cuba in modern times. But you guys,
I'm probably shorting England and Scotland, which in those days
we were hitchhiking again, and we get picked up by lorries.
Yeah.
And the average lorry driver in the UK was a very educated man, you know, just like mm-hmm. the taxi drivers. And they were very great. In fact, in England, this is an amazing thing. I'd walk into a bar, and I'd say one or two words, and I couldn't buy a drink.
Could really?
Because I was a Yank.
Huh.
And this is only 20 years after the, no, 15, yeah, about 21 years after the war with, no, 19, my math is right, 45 to 64, so it's 19 years
yeah.
after the war's over.
Wow.
And I could not buy a drink. Hey, Yank, come over here, you know, and then they, in Scotland, it was funny, I'd get in there and we'd have a couple of wee toddies, you know, and or whatever they called them up there, and I'd talk to these Scots. They have really a thick accent, and we're at 3 hours of drinking scotch, and we're fast friends, and what did he say? I didn't have an idea. He understood everything I said,
yeah.
He was watching the telly with American shows on it. I didn't understand anything he said, but we're good buddies, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing, you know, like thinking about how that you know, I did a European backpacking trip out of college, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I went around, and you know, the impression of Americans, I think you mentioned that, you know, lots of people, the ugly American, right? So there's that perception, but that apparently has always been there. But in terms of like that amazing outpouring of goodwill, that's just not there anymore. But I wouldn't say, like, at least when I went around, that, you know, people hated Americans. They might have hated the United States as a country, but like Americans, they're very much interested, you know, like like you mentioned, they wanted to talk to you about,
you know, I've been all through Africa and South America, and my saying is always this: people are not the problem in this world. Governments are the problem.
Yeah.
Every person, every Maasai villager I've met in my life, or in up in the Andes meeting some little Mayan, you know, guy, they're all great and gracious and nice. It's the governments that create the problem. So,
and that reminds me, you know, I was talking, some cab driver, he's, you know, I get into some cab, and I think it was actually Switzerland. I did go to Switzerland. And, you know, he was like, oh, you're American. He's like, I love Americans. America's great. But Bush, you know, because Bush was in power. And this guy did not like Bush
at
all.
No, they didn't like Bush at all. Yeah, he was the
Bush.
Cowboy.
And yeah. He's like, but I love Americans. And I'm like, oh, that's an interesting perspective, you know.
Well, they probably say the same thing about Trump, although I didn't hear much the last time I was there. But
yeah, you know, I think it's interesting because, you know, someone once told me this, and they're talking, I forget what country they're from, but they had a country that had some sort of dictator, or otherwise they were not happy with their leader, right? And, you know, the way they looked at it is, they're like, look, you know, like, I don't like the guy that's in charge of your country right now. And I guess you don't either. Welcome to the club, buddy. You know,
right,
like,
right.
And that was kind of like a bonding moment, because they're like, you know, like, yeah, look at what we have to deal with. Like, we rarely like the guy that's in charge of our
right.
country here. So, you know.
So that's a common. Yeah.
But, you know, like you said, if you're a nice person and you're forthcoming and everything,
exactly.
And honest.
But after
you don't skip out on bar tabs, you know.
Yeah, you don't do dumb things like that. But the Second World War was a great bonding, because you had this tremendous evil, and you were fighting.
Yeah.
And for example, we've got a member here. He's 95 years old. His name is Roy Rausch, and he fought in Guadalcanal, Tinian, and about three other islands. The First Marine fights with the Japanese. Well, he went to New Zealand.
Uh-huh.
And the New Zealands and the Australians, after the Japanese had taken over most of the Pacific, including the Philippines and Indonesia, they thought that they were going to be next. So they just treated those Americans like gold, you know. And that goodwill in both New Zealand and Australia is still there.
Yeah. So after England, where'd you guys go?
Went back and got the boat, and then we went to New York, and I spent some time in New York this time, and we saw some sights there.
So you made it back to the United States.
And then,
wow.
And then I got a car, Cadillac, that was
your
one
own?
Of these deals, no, where you drive it, and they give you a credit card for gas, and I had to get it back to Alameda, California.
Oh, that's a good deal.
It was, yeah, it was a Coupe de Ville. It wasn't bad.
Yeah. And you drove backwards into a lot of lucky situations.
So we drove that all the way across country.
Wow.
And we ran out of money in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And so I had to call my dad, and he mailed me $50. Or what do you do it?
Western Union.
Yeah, Western Union. Yeah. $50 in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And that was I've got enough for gas, and $50 was enough to get from Wyoming to San Francisco.
Man, what a trip.
So
what an adventure. 21 years old, yeah.
I was still 21 when I got back. I turned 22 the next month.
Wow.
So it was a great entree into the world for me. I mean, it was, again, if you are open to new ideas and new people, you learn so much. I took my grandkids to Europe this year. We've got one grandkid that plays in an orchestra, and so we followed him to Dresden and, oh no, not Dresden. He played in Berlin, Leipzig, and Prague right after Christmas this year. So the whole family went over. I got a 6-month-old grandson, an 8-year-old grandson, 13-year-old grandson, and this boy's 18. And we're traveling around Europe with the whole family. But to watch the 8-year-old, Germany, we get up one morning, Grandpa, how do you say good morning in German? Good morning. And how do you say thank you? You know, danke schön. And I could never teach him German here.
Right.
Because that'd be like learning, you know. But
yeah.
But he was there just
sopping
up that culture. Yeah. And of course, it's not that much different than us. It's Europe, but we were in France. And Germany and the Czech Republic, and so they're all different. They have different languages, different cultures, different. And I think it's such a great way for people to learn. And I wish more of our countrymen traveled more, because I think we'd be a lot more thankful for what we have, and humble.
Yeah.
Than we are sometimes.
I think we forget that at the Adventurers Club a lot, because you know I throw a stone and. Everybody's been everywhere.
Yeah, these guys have been everywhere.
But sometimes you forget that, like, you know, the majority of people don't travel.
They've not been out of their state, let alone to other countries. And the dog's sitting over here. Maybe you can get a shot of the dog.
Yeah, let Leo run in here.
He's 14, or you can turn him loose.
So what we normally do at the end, Rob, is we offer a chance for people to ask questions. So Andy's been, you know, this is a live broadcast. I don't know if you know that, but, you know, a bunch of people are watching, and I can see that comment stream.
How many are watching? Do we know?
Good question. Andy's anyway, Leo off the chain.
What I was going to say about, I forgot it now.
Well, what I was going to say, excuse me, but we offer people a chance to ask questions. And as long as Leo doesn't knock over any cameras or lights.
Hey, Leo.
Leo,
here. Here.
Oh.
Sit.
Look at this giant Leo. Dog.
Sit. Leo, sit.
Oh,
good boy.
Oh. So this is your bird dog, right?
Yeah, it's my bird dog.
Don't drink.
But he's what I was going to say about traveling. He's only 14 months old. He's been to 2 countries, Canada, Mexico, and 7 states.
Wow, you're a well-traveled boy. You're a good boy. You're a good boy.
Here, Leo.
So hopefully people have been asking
Leo,
questions
here.
In that comment section, and we might have some questions from the viewers there. So, Andy, we have any questions out there that we can field?
Sit.
Absolutely. Let me start here with the comments. We got Rock Roll saying, watching from the cliffs of Mount Hershner. Good to hear from you. Parviz Malakuti, sorry if I butchered that, watching from Vegas.
Sit.
Hello. Matt 90068, cheers from Hollywood.
Sit.
Hello to you.
Leo.
Captain Jim, Mammoth Lakes, sit. Brian Brecht, Raleigh, North Carolina. Michelle Fernandez says, hi, Dad.
Sit.
You know Michelle?
Michelle Fernandez says, hi, daughter. Dad.
Oh, there you go. She says, hi, Dad. Hey, Michelle.
Hi, Michelle.
Thanks
hi,
for
Michelle.
Tuning in.
Thanks for tuning in.
Who else we got on there?
David Hayen says, Rob, we're looking forward to hearing your stories. I think he speaks for all of us. Dan Dobson writes in. He says, I took the one pair of jeans/backpack approach. Damn, should have bought a sport jacket.
Yep.
You never know when you're going to need to sneak into those embassy parties. And in terms of that, and last one here, we got Peter Almquist says, Jaguar, the real adventurer.
So no questions in the comment thread this time. Yeah.
Oh, we do have one. We have one from Parviz Malakuti. Again, sorry if I butchered your name. They ask, your single favorite city from that trip?
Oh, that's a good one. What is your single favorite city?
City in that trip?
you know, in all your single favorite they're, in all they're of Europe,
so,
right?
They're so different. I would say big cities, probably Rome, because of the food and the culture and the everything that was there. But I mean, how do you compare Rome to Cairo or?
You know, it is crazy. Like Rome, I was thinking about Rome, and I wrote this in my little journal that I have, right? For me, Rome was like three independent cities, and you could spend a whole trip.
Yeah, and or an independent country. You got the Vatican right there.
Well, So there's modern day Rome, which is fantastic.
Right.
Right. Then there's ancient Rome.
Right.
And then there's the Vatican. Yeah, that's so at four. And then the fourth is like the Renaissance Rome.
Right.
But there's all like each one of those things.
It's an amazing.
And it's spread across the entire city. So since it's so historical and there's layers and layers and layers, like I really love that city too.
And I haven't been back.
Yeah.
I have not been back since 1964.
Again, you can go there and just say, I'm going to do Renaissance Rome. Yeah. And all you do is that. And then you can come back another time and spend another couple weeks. And all you're doing is like ancient Rome.
Yeah.
So
if we ever get beyond all this stuff that's going on right now, I'd love to go back to, I would say that would probably be the best.
So the corollary to that question is, what was your favorite country and why? And then one more here, what did you do for most of your life? So what was your favorite country and then what did you do for most of your life?
Country, probably Egypt, not because of the Egyptians, but because they were a pretty backward lot. But the monuments and the you know, you're stepping back into time.
Yeah.
It was just amazing. What did I do after I came back the following year? I went to work for LA County as a personnel guy and learned the ropes and ended up moving very quickly in that business. I became the youngest manager. This is for the county of LA. We had 76,000 employees. And I was in charge of campus recruitment, meaning we recruited engineers, accountants, and administrative people all over 11 Western states. Then I moved to the data processing department, and I was the business manager for all of the computers for LA County, 76 departments that aren't talking to each other, you know, and our 44 departments. But this was when computers were just starting. So we had Burroughs, we had Xerox, we had IBM, we had Honeywell, all these different computers, each department, the cops would have this, the courts had IBM, and they didn't even talk to each other.
It might still be like that.
Yeah, well, it is. My son-in-law's in it, and he says it still is. But and then I last 16 years, I went to work for the courts, and they were kind of backward and needed a business backing, and it took me about 7 years to get people to quit calling. When they'd come into the courthouse, they had a traffic ticket, they'd call them violators. And I said, this guy isn't a violator, he got a traffic ticket.
Yeah. You know?
So we called them customers. And I don't know if they lost that after I left, but that's the way I think we should, the government should treat people. Like,
Yeah.
We got two more questions from the chat here.
Here we go. Pick it up.
Where would you go if you were going to take the same kind of trip today? Thank you, Michael Bershad.
Same kind, meaning same areas.
Well, like a backpack, I think around. Like if you're gonna pick up. Oh, if I was gonna
tell, because I'm not gonna do it, but if I was gonna mention that to somebody.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, there's not many places that are that safe. I'll tell you a little known fact, and a beautiful area is South America, and you pretty much have to speak Spanish. Cuba's a great place to go. Very safe. See, you can't travel through the Middle East anymore. You go, Morocco is probably fine, but other than that,
isn't South America kind of dangerous too?
I don't think so. I've been there. Yeah, I mean, I didn't think so.
Yeah.
So, Leo, get out of here. You're causing trouble.
I don't know. He's like, I'm a good boy. Where's that wide shot, Andy?
He's causing trouble.
Look at this guy. Yeah.
And then the last question from the chat that we're going to do is, what was one or two of the most memorable characters you met during your trip?
Like out of all the people, that bartender that ran you out?
No, he wasn't, very impressive. I think that's an interesting question. There was a woman who I met on the plane who was an American, and she lived with a German engineer in Stuttgart, which is where they made Mercedes-Benz.
And she and I used to, even though I don't think her husband liked it very much, but there was nothing going on, but we'd take these long talks, and she'd been in Europe long enough to...
You'd take these long talks?
Or we'd take these long walks and have talks. She was very philosophical, very interesting gal. And then I met this cut-up, I didn't even mention this, when I was in Stuttgart. I met this Australian, and he was an agent for some guy, a right-hand drive Mercedes-Benz, the four-seater convertible.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I drove that. I'd forgotten that whole story. We drove that from Stuttgart up to Bremen to put it on a boat to go back to Australia. Now, talk about a flashy outfit that was. Mercedes convertible, just off of the line, it had about 200 kilometers on it when we were done with
it. How fast did you get it up to?
Huh?
How fast did you go?
In the Autobahn, I don't even remember, but probably over 200 clicks.
Wow.
So he was an interesting guy.
Well, do we have any more questions, Andy?
No more questions, but Alyssa Zapeta says, this was awesome, Dad.
Dad, your kids are tuning in.
I got my fans. That's awesome.
Yeah, my fan club. You got a pretty big fan club.
I've got two lovely daughters, and I'm very blessed that we've got a very close-knit family, and we live close to each other.
Homer Tom says, thank you, Adventurers Club and Rob Quist, for a wonderful presentation and for live streaming. Hope to see the club again someday. And Parviz says, great interview. Good job, guys.
All right. Well, Mr. Quist, thank you for coming. Thank you for being our guest here tonight.
Thank you.
We appreciate you. We love hearing these stories of adventure. I'm sure our viewers all were just as amazed as I was at all the things that took place. So this is the Adventurers Club of Los Angeles. Thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe to our channel and click that bell to be notified. Have a great week, everybody.